getting back to this whole idea of knowing when we are dealing with stress is vitally important. And that's not something that anybody else can do for you. I mean, if you are in a relationship, you can always, if you have enough guts, you can always ask them, how do I act when I get stressed out? They will definitely tell you. But I think it's important that we recognize that when these stressful things happen to us, that we know we need to do something. And the last section, the unit, or the number five, it affects our sense of meaning and purpose, or our relationship to our understanding of God, is vitally important. I know one time when I was teaching in a fire department, there was somebody that from Public Works who was in the room, and they said, "Well, I don't believe in God, so this doesn't matter to me." And I said to him almost immediately, "Well, do you have a sense of meaning and purpose in your life?" And he said, "Absolutely." And I said, "Well, if you're under a whole lot of stress, you're not going to get as much joy out of your sense of meaning and purpose." And so being able to acknowledge these five areas and to be able to recognize how they play out in our lives, what we do to help us ourselves and what we do to hurt ourselves is vitally, vitally important. So we don't always recognize what's going on inside of us. And as we talked about before, triggers can happen to any of us, on any given day. It's a way in which the brain actually reminds us that we have stuff going on inside of us. And as I was starting to say when I got cut off, I was serving working with first responders after a critical incident, and this boy eventually died. And when it came my turn, because we were talking about this, to talk, I normally present for maybe 12 to 15 minutes on how to take care of yourself after horrible things happen. And I literally was so emotionally jammed up inside, I could barely speak. And I had no idea what was going on with me. I did say a few things and then I passed it on to somebody else. But later on, what I realized was that this young boy at 11, who eventually died, triggered off the fact that my daughter was in dealing with cancer at the time, and she was having regular chemo treatments and everything else. I had no idea that I was on some level dealing with that, because when I walked into that room, and there were about 30 of us in there, it was still in the back of my head, and I didn't know it, but that event triggered off a very painful event in me. And I took the time after I got home. And one of the questions you can ask yourself when a trigger happens, because we don't always know where they come from, is when did I experience a similar type of event? Or when did I experience a similar emotion that was very painful? And as soon as I asked that question to myself, I immediately thought of my daughter. And then after that happened, I called her and we talked, and it worked out well. But for me, it reminded me of the power of triggers. And because they come out of the unconscious, we don't know that we're holding on to those unresolved issues, but they are very powerful when they happen.
And just to highlight, as Fred shares that, and this is the reframing that we think about, where they can obviously be incredibly powerful, very present. They can come up out of nowhere. They can be very scary, and yet they are an opportunity to grow and heal in those areas. And so this language that again may sound strange, but that trigger was a gift to Fred that showed this area of his life that he still needed to process. And it can happen to any of us.
So what happens if we don't take care of ourselves or we ignore our triggers? We can have physical and mental exhaustion. We can move in and become rather numb. We have a poorer quality of life. We know that there are, especially during the pandemic, there were increased suicides and homicides. We know our health goes down. There is more crime, more long-term disability for children. They have many more school-related problems. There's a greater use of healthcare, and which actually enters into ignoring self-care increases our financial burdens. Many people understand and agree with this concept about the need for self-care, but still many of us choose to ignore it. So you need to think about, what are the consequences that you know of in your own life when you don't take time to care for yourself? Think about that for a moment. Think about how you feel. Think about how you relate to other people. Think about what you do, because these are real life issues. And often people who don't take care of themselves, you know, end up with depressive affect or anxiety or other mental health issues. Sometimes it's recognizing what gets in the way of good self-care. Sometimes it's situational. So often when we think about taking care of ourselves, we say to ourselves, well, I don't do a good job. That's just because I'm lazy. And I don't think that's true. Sometimes situationally, at any given point in life, it's just not time to take care of yourself. I know as a pastor one time when I buried the a guy who was married and had three children, and I did some bereavement counseling with the wife, and she said, I don't have time to take care of what's going on in me. I have to take care of my children. And she was absolutely right. So when we think about not taking care of ourselves, it's important to have an attitude of compassion towards ourselves. Does that make sense? So many of us, because we like to help others, tend to follow in the idea that we're the first to respond, but the last to seek help. Chris?
So there's a story, something that in the early days of COVID that Fred and I had heard that impacted us about Christine. She was 35 years old, and she was a hospital nurse in a children's cancer unit and had been doing that work for about 10 years. And she could tell plenty of joyful stories about children whose treatment had succeeded in overcoming those illnesses. But there were also many stories that she didn't talk about and share about the pain and loss and hardship of her work. And she would actually say they were memories that would haunt her at night when she tried to sleep. And she actually started to question her calling and even her faith as she tried to understand why this was happening, why children and families were being impacted, why there was so much pain. She even say that, you know, most days she would even cry in her car on the way to work, but she couldn't stand the thought of leaving her job. And her supervisor had suggested to her, you know, you should go to counseling. But she thought this was kind of an insult to what she thought was her professional skills, what they should be, how she should be able to handle it. And I know, you know, in the work we do in volunteering and caring for people, managing our own backpacks while we're trying to support people with their backpacks, you know, some of this may resonate with you, the things that we carry around, the questions we have. And in the past 2 years, Fred and I have spoken to countless professionals and volunteers who are dedicated to helping those dealing with significant issues and crises, and yet are also struggling themselves, both because of what they're exposed to, but also how it's impacting them. And they can often have that daily struggle. Can I keep doing this? Can I stay here? I want to help, but. And so for many jobs and roles and functions and volunteer agencies, you know, exposure to these things is an occupational hazard. But it's essential, as Fred had mentioned earlier, to see how we are personally being affected. You know, is there an orange flag or a red flag so that we can practice self-care? And even more importantly, know when to ask for help. And then growing this into the culture of the groups and agencies that we're working for. So we're not just sending off a signal flare, but it's actually built in to our agency to create spaces to talk, like in that wonderful sharing we had before the Zoom apocalypse, where, you know, people were just sharing from their hearts. It was an incredibly powerful, impactful, beautiful moment to hear each of you sharing. And our goal is to build those type of opportunities into groups and agencies. But at the same time, there can sometimes be a limited acceptance of how these issues affect us. So another differentiation we like to talk about is, as we're working and dealing with long-term stressful exposures, is the difference between burnout and stress. And one simple definition: stress is over-engagement, while burnout is disengagement. And as we've talked to people and said, how would you define those two terms? How would you define them personally for you, not just academically, but experientially? And people would say stress is often, to me, related to an event or a situation or an issue. There can be a lot more emotional reactions, like a spike or anxiety, or my stomach's upset, or I feel pressure on my head, maybe a hyped up, stimulated feeling. One person said, my spirituality is still active, but it's very, very focused on the specific issue and need in front of me. But as stress becomes cumulative, it can lead into burnout and burnout syndrome, where people had very different descriptions of some of these words, where they would use words like, I feel numb, shut down, gray, hopeless, I don't see an end in sight, I don't really want to engage in relationships. Even in my spirituality, it's turned to more of a why bother, because I wonder, am I even going to get an answer? And even little examples and actions that we do can become exhausting.
So in the next series of slides, I'm going to talk about different phases of stress and how different people are affected differently. So if you can remember this simple 1 through 4 a way of seeing stress, I think it's helpful to do. When most of us start out in our volunteer work, we start out with lots of care and optimism. We know that compassion is a significant part of our life. our work is very fulfilling. And when we speak with people, they recognize that we're fully being present to them. And when we come home, we can share those moments with other people because it's all positive. That's what we call stage one. Stage two is after we may have been volunteering for a while or professionally working in the mental health field, and we begin to notice that the work that we do has an impact on us. We call that vicarious trauma, secondary traumatization, or caregiver fatigue. You notice the emotional impact on the work you do. The stress of the work may begin to show up in a variety of ways. You still enjoy your work, but you may begin to pull back from it, or you respond by being over-engaged, but you're still actively caring. And at stage two, it's important to realize that there is a need to talk about this stuff with someone. And if your spouse or a friend says to you, well, how's your work going? I think it's helpful just to say a little bit, but not a lot. Like after I come back from a day at work, or, if it's been a difficult day, or if I come back from a deployment someplace, my wife will ask me, how did it go? And the only thing I would share with her is, like, for example, when I was in Texas after the floods, I'd say, well, a lot of people were affected, but I had some good barbecue. And that would really be about it, because I don't share trauma stories with my wife or my kids, for that matter. And that's stage two. You realize that the work that you're doing is affecting you, but you still can somewhat control it. Stage three is really a critical point for all of us. And both Chris and I have been there at times. It's a movement towards getting burned out. Secondary PTSD or compassion fatigue is certainly a part of our life. We have less energy and motivation. It now hurts to do your job. And you begin to wonder if the work you do even matters. This is the impact of listening to trauma over time. Self-care is needed. The tiredness just won't go away. Charles Figley, who developed the concept of compassion fatigue, writes, at this point, you still love your job, but it's seriously influencing you. And at stage three, we can and should utilize peer-to-peer support or a mental health provider. You need to talk to a trauma-informed friend, rabbi, priest, chaplain, pastor, imam, or meet with a, as I said before, a trauma-informed therapist. Chris?
We had talked briefly about my deployment to Haiti, and like I'd shared, I'd had all the right trainings and the right heart. And even though it was a terrible situation, I was grateful for the chance to go help people. But what I was exposed to and what I saw, and literally every single person that I met with there, was dealing with severe trauma impact. And I remember when I got back, there was no real plan to help me process what I'd been through. There was the 800 phone number, 1-800-CALL-CRISIS or whatever, but nothing real comprehensive. And though I'd been successful, I was literally just going through the motions of my life for about the next 6 months. I was getting about an hour of sleep a night. Checking an email was exhausting. At this point, I literally thought every day about quitting because I didn't want to feel that way again. I was able to find some mental health support, which again is part of the reason why we talk about this now. And that did help me get my feet back under me. And I was probably about a 3.9 out of 4 on this 4-stage chart that Fred talks about. And as I said before, I'm a changed person because of that deployment. I'm a different version of me. My fiance got a different version of Chris when I came back from Haiti. At the same time, one of the main reasons that I do this training and to help others so they don't have to figure out what I had to figure out the hard way. And this would be an example of post-traumatic growth that we're going to talk about a little bit later in this course.
So we've talked about 3. So what is stage 4, which is burnout? You really don't care anymore. There is within you a significant pulling away from any work, whether it's volunteer or paid. There's a loss of optimism as well as hope, and you may need to find a new line of work. As a volunteer, you may experience depression, anxiety, or suicidal ideation, and there is definitely a need for significant change in lifestyle and possibly a new understanding of self. And the only person you can really talk to, really, at this point, is either find someone who can figure out other volunteer work you can do, or you can go to an employment agency, because when you're burnt out, when you're fully burnt out, you can't go back. Do you know this? Do you know anyone that this has happened to, Chris?
I remember meeting someone who'd been a local emergency manager. And when I told him that I also did disaster work, he started to tell me about how he'd started out really, really liking his work. Felt great about the opportunity to help people plan, did the job for about 8 years. But then he said that over the past couple years, the job had just gotten much harder. And he was coming home more stressed. He was being asked to do more, but with no real additional help. He was coming home and being short and impatient with his kids and family. And it was changing his whole life. And he said, I'm going to get out. And he ended up changing to an admin job at the town hall, and said that he was doing much better and much happier. And this same scenario, just as an awareness that it can take place in any number of jobs, from social services to nonprofits to volunteer work. And so it's important to think about these 4 stages and the direction that we may be going and where we are so that we can make the right choices to take care of ourselves.
So we've been spending a lot of time talking about those difficult moments in life. And that's only part of what we teach. So with that background, what can we do about it? How can we be resilient? So we're going to focus on a concept which some of you have heard me speak about before, but it's called post-traumatic growth, or PTG. And that is the ability of an individual to grow from difficult events. We can all learn and grow from abnormal or difficult or even disaster events that have occurred to us. Darwin might have said, evolve or die. And we're going to use a series of ideas out of the world of sports to talk about this. Here's some examples of how people and groups have grown after a disaster. And even though this is the world of sports, it has real implications for the work that we all do.
So as a Massachusettsian and a Bostonian, I remember back in 2013 when the Boston Red Sox had come off last place finish the season before and starting the season with real high hopes before everything was put on hold because of the Boston Marathon bombing. And it took a few weeks, took place a few weeks into the season, and it changed the whole focus away from baseball, obviously. But from the first Red Sox game after the bombing that they played, all of Boston was able to rally around their baseball team. And the Red Sox did not disappoint by reeling off a surprising run to win the American League East division title, pulled off a dramatic comeback in the championship, and then finally went on to win the World Series and bring home their eighth championship. And once they had the trophy, they had a very powerful moment that where they placed that trophy on the Boston Marathon finish line to show what they did for the city and for the fans. It was incredibly powerful.
I know after Hurricane Katrina that the New Orleans Saints went on to win the 2010 Super Bowl. I know that because I was there when that happened. And I was witnessing a cultural change in New Orleans, because a positive cultural change in New Orleans because of Katrina.
And then just months after the a tsunami tore through Japan, the Japan women's soccer team won the FIFA World Cup against the USA. So maybe you can start to see a theme with some of these stories we're sharing.
It even happened in the tough world of rugby. Just months after the cyclone Yasi roared into Queensland's coast, Australia came close to winning the 2011 Rugby World Cup, going all the way to the semifinals. So why is this happening? It happens to us as individuals. It also happens to teams, and it happens through communities. Any ideas? Well, here's what one ESPN sports analyst wrote. Chris, you want to read that?
Sure. So Stone Robb explained, the correlation between countries that are torn apart by natural disasters such as hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes is evident. So if you find yourself doing some online betting or putting a few bucks on a Super Bowl score at work, make sure you always go for the team that was most recently crapped on by Mother Nature. Your odds of winning will be that much greater.
So there's something within the human personality, the perseverance to either to win or to overcome our past is there. I think we're genetically hard-coded that way. It's true not only of teams, but of individuals as well. I know on the night when, right after Michael Jordan's father died, he had, in basketball, he played this amazing, amazing game. So stress and trauma can positively transform our lives. And it turns out that suffering can be the catalyst that pushes people to get stronger and find new or more meaning in life. It has an interesting beginning. Many years ago in the 1990s, there was a Yale researcher who studied Vietnam vets who were prisoners of war. So he was studied them. There were about 100 people that he studied, and he studied them about 30 years after their experience of being a POW. So just imagine being a POW, if you can wrap your head around that. The researcher found that 61 percent of those vets describe their current life as having more meaning and purpose because of their time in captivity. When I read that research, it was like my head did a 360. Like, how can that even happen? You know, it was just beyond my scope to think that somebody who was a POW could have a better quality of life 30 years later because of their experience. There was a long time before anything was done with that study until two other researchers read it, and their names were Tedeschi and Calhoun. They published since then, and they developed the idea of PTG, or post-traumatic growth. So why is this so important for us to understand? Well, as someone who provides care for others, I will never share when someone is telling me about the worst day of their life. You know, I don't say, well, don't worry about it, you're going to grow from it. No, I don't go there. But when people are sharing horrible, horrible stories inside of me, I know that they can grow from that experience. And it allows me to be more compassionate, more hopeful, and more peaceful as I listen to people. Mm-hmm. And I know that at some point that they can develop more meaning and purpose. And so as I share this for you, with you all, know that on your darkest days, they can also be turned into opportunities for growth.
So if I can just say, so what you're saying is this is for us to process inside of ourselves as we might offer care for another person. Because I remember I went through a sexual assault when I was like 17. And really close after that, someone, because I grew up Catholic, she said, you're a Catholic and you know you have to forgive him. And my reaction, I won't come here, but you can probably imagine it was very angry and very vitriolic. I was so hurt that I didn't want to speak to that person again for a long time.
Well, of course.
But yeah, just a cautionary thing. I think timing is everything in this care business, that, you know, when you say something is really important, and when you don't say something is really important.
Absolutely.
And the reason why I share this is, first of all, I think we have to integrate the concept for ourselves. You know, I know that after difficult things happened in my life, I knew that that I needed to get help. And I know that help was out there. I went and, you know, I spent 6 months weekly going to a trauma-informed therapist. And I'm extremely grateful for that time with her. And I grew from that. So I think sometimes when people go through difficult moments in their life, they just think that they are going to be stuck with these horrible images inside of them for the rest of their life. And they are going to have these memories of horrible emotions that come up occasionally. What I do know personally is that when difficult things happen, we don't forget the content of things happening. However, through appropriate trauma-informed therapy, we can work through the emotions of it. So the emotions of those terrible experiences, we don't have to live with them anymore. And I think that's really important for people to understand. You know, I had some abusive parents growing up, and I still remember some of the things that happened, but it doesn't bug me anymore. I don't get that feeling of rage or anger anymore, which was amazing to me because I lived with that stuff for a long, long time.
And to add to that, I find, you know, personally, because of what I've been through, I often don't have to say anything. And people know that I understand. Even if the specific scenario is different, my compassion, because of what I've been through, I often don't even have to say anything. And I think, to the point of post-traumatic growth, as I'm listening to someone share, and the more I do this, the less I say back, but that there's a hope in me that I think people can pick up on, because I now know personally that there's hope and growth through those things. And just looking back at some of the experiences that were done about this, about the value of meaning, and we talk about things we can't be in control of, but there are these tools and resources that we can, as we move into this post-traumatic growth fear. And these are some thoughts from Dr. Viktor Frankl, and some of you may have heard of him before, where he developed a school of thought that proposed that even in the trauma and tragedies of life, we can still find meaning. And that from this meaning, we can find empowerment and new purposes from it. Now, he had developed this theory before he was placed in a Nazi concentration camp. And his encounters with the worst of human conditions ended up providing him with an unwanted laboratory that actually confirmed his theory. And he saw that those in the camps who were trying to actively find meaning were more likely to survive. And the attitude that we take towards whatever we're dealing with is one of the things that allows us to grow through these incredibly difficult events. And I can share that when I talked about the 2010 Haiti earthquakes, that when I started being able to, when I chose to start talking about it and being real about it, it started to open up my backpack. And I started not only be able to unpack it for myself, but then shift my focus to be able to help others deal with whatever they were carrying around. And, you know, final quote where Viktor Frankl says, when we're no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves, coming from someone with some of the most difficult experiences that we can imagine.
What's so interesting to me is that neurologists have discovered that when we develop more meaning and purpose in our lives, our brain produces what we call the happy hormones, the serotonin, the dopamine, the oxytocin, and the endorphins. And they're hormones produced by the brain that promote positive feelings like pleasure, happiness, and even love when we find deeper meaning in life after experiencing suffering. So it's like our brain confirms that when we develop more meaning, that it confirms that we're on the right track. When we begin to process our stress and trauma, it can turn into post-traumatic growth. Or you can, you know, I often say that people after a difficult moment either go in the direction of PTSD or PTG, one way or the other. Post-traumatic growth, though, actually begins when we fully accept where we are in the here and now. That's not always an easy thing to do. But when that happens, we can find deeper meaning. People who have found PTG in their life make better friendships. Many develop or return to their former spirituality. Many people, after a PTG moments in their lives, go on to serve in humanitarian efforts. And many people report that they're much happier and more at peace with themselves. When that happens, because of post-traumatic growth, we can end up being so much more compassionate with self and with others. There's a lot of writing on this. If you Google on post-traumatic growth, there's one book in particular called Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth. And the author talks about this guy who loved to jump out of airplanes with these squirrel suits on, which, you know, and with the parachute, but they would just jump out of these planes and weave in and around these huge cliffs, and then at the last moment open up their parachute. I think they might have mental health issues to do that. But there was one story about this guy who was in his 30s and was doing this and didn't open up his parachute in time. And at the last minute, he opened it up and he ended up breaking every bone in his body when he hit the ground. He ended up surviving, but he also ended up being a quadriplegic, couldn't move from the neck on down. And after his recovery, what was so remarkable is he is quoted as saying that he has a better quality of life now as a paraplegic than he did when he was a fully abled individual. Because he fully accepted it, he found deeper meaning, he made better friendships, he helped other quadriplegics out. And it's not that he's grateful for that happening, but for him to be able to say that he's much happier and more at peace with himself, I think is just an amazing, amazing commentary on post-traumatic growth. So what we know about stress is that stress is cumulative. We just build up our backpacks over time. It's so important for each of us to own how heavy our backpack is. And sometimes we can see or experience how heavy it is because we lose a sense of purpose. And when we begin to lose a sense of purpose, that needs to be seen as a wake-up call. And maybe you have too many rocks in your backpack. It is so helpful to process your backpack stuff with your colleagues. And just from the conversations that went on earlier, I'm wondering within your organization if you have regular meetings where people just share stories. You know, this doesn't have to be led by some high IQ mental health provider. I think anybody who has good listening skills can be a facilitator of this. But most important for all of us to know is that the stress that so many of us experience in life is a normal reaction to what we have been through in life.
Yeah, actually, Inclusive Diversity of California is beginning listening sessions. And we're beginning that right after our convention, starting in April, and we'll be moving forward with that specifically because we think it would be helpful.
Well, I know it will be. And so what's so interesting, when Chris and I teach for FEMA, there is a breakout room and people get to talk. And each time we do this, people say to us, we didn't have enough time. And so we have to say, well, this really isn't a support group. We're here to teach you. So anyway, Chris.
And having those places to talk and share from people saying, it's good to know I'm not alone. And we're just finding more and more that as you, I think you call it, listening groups, incredibly powerful and effective as a next step. So as we continue to strengthen this phrase that I love, our personal resiliency portfolio, one of the straightforward and accessible tools is to focus on making choices around what we are in control of actually versus the many things that we can't control, whether personally, professionally, volunteers, people we work with. So some of the things we can't control could include others' reactions. You know, how long this will last. That was something someone said during COVID. Or maybe I've got people that have deployed to Ohio after the train derailment. Questions about who's in charge of the country and politics. Can't control that necessarily on the big picture. About official policy at work, you know, certain leadership, the weather. We can't control those things. But some of the things that we can control, and this may sound simple, just turning off the TV. You know, we can get that overflow of stimuli and information or the radio or podcasts, limiting social media. You know, again, the fire hose of thoughts and ideas and feedback and positions. We can be in control of our attitude, you know, who we interact with, the boundaries that we put up for ourselves to protect us and take care of ourselves. We can choose our self-care. And I'm sure there are other things that you can think of in both these areas as well. And I'm finding out that many people, even those who have an understanding of this concept, call it at an academic level, they'll still continue to be sucked into ruminating on the things that they can actually do nothing about. They spend their time on those things. But reminding ourselves of this, which we're doing, and every time I teach this, I'm reminding myself right alongside everybody else. And it was interesting, there was one clinician who said that they had this taped to their mirror as a daily reminder. This was a professional whose job was to help take care of other people. They had to remind themselves daily to take the positive steps and focus on what they could change instead of being sucked into the jet wash. Two other practical tools, and these are some of my favorites when I do them. One of them is a boundary ritual, and one of them is reframing. And the boundary ritual is a simple and specific mindfulness exercise that you can perform at the boundary between work and home, whatever that looks like for you. An actual office, I call it my COVID dungeon office basement where I've been spending a lot of time. Because have you ever noticed, you know, when you come home from work or a project or from volunteering and you're still thinking about the issues that were there and you're kind of stuck there in your head, you know, where a part of your mind stays on the gerbil wheel, you know, back at the office or the people you were working with. And then you can't be completely present when you get home. You can't recharge, and you're still being drained by those thoughts of where you are. So a boundary ritual is a conscious choice that you can make to help take your work hat off when you come home. And it's simple things. It could be listening to special music when you get home from work or on, you know, opening the front door. One person talked about, well, I change my clothes when I get home. I take off my work clothes and I put on my home clothes, just like Mr. Rogers did. Taking the dog for a walk, sitting in your favorite chair with a cup of tea. There's a song for me. It's the song Home from Philip Phillips. It was played in the Olympics a while back. And now when I leave my dungeon basement office, I found literally even after doing that three times, that boundary ritual over the course of a week, even when walking upstairs to be with my family, I could feel the work clutter was substantially reduced in my head. So I just want you to think about something you might be able to do. It could be breathing, you know, when you're putting your hand on your front door. Another practical tool is reframing. And this is something that every person has the ability to do with stressful situations. And it's basically the habits of the mind, the choices we make can then impact how we perceive the stressor in front of us, and then ultimately how we handle it. Now, this doesn't mean that we put on rose-colored glasses and pretend it's not there or that everything's fine, but we look at the issues and challenges in a more positive and productive way. And it can be very practical and straightforward. It could be with a crisis. I remember when I was in Haiti after the earthquakes, I mentioned that, and there was a truck that was rumbling and banging down the street, and the sound of the truck hitting on the road, I was with a family in their apartment, and they instantly went into full panic mode because it reminded them of the sounds of the earthquake. And there was someone who had taught me there. I just literally had them say out loud with me, "That's just a truck." They'd say, "That's just a truck. I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm safe. It's just a truck." We knew this building had been checked by engineers, so we could say that. And just in that 2 minutes, I could see their stress and anxiety level reduce right away. Another example Fred and I had in one of our trainings when we're doing this, and someone said, "I just have this negative thought pounding through my head all the time where I just feel so bad about myself." They said, "I've been gaining weight during COVID and I can't do anything to stop it." And you could see how frustrated and dejected they felt. And so we said, "Well, take a moment to reframe that into one positive action that you can be in control of." And they thought for a minute and came back and said, "You know what? I will plan to choose one meal today that's healthier, one choice." And you could literally see the positive shift in their face and eyes because they were able to take a little more control over what was overwhelming to them.
For those of you that this high idea of cognitive reframing is sounds a little clinical, it's really not that difficult, but you need to wrap your head around the concept. I know on one deployment that I was serving after some flooding in West Virginia, I was working with quite a few people in a shelter. And I noticed that this woman had three kids outside on the lawn of this high school. And when I came up to her, she kept on talking about what a horrible mother she was because they rented this house, which ended up getting flooded out because of the floods. And what a horrible person she was. And so, and I'm hearing her angst, hearing, you know, and her kids, of course, are listening to her, their mother talk about this. And all I said to her, I said, "Ma'am, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is I see you as a superhero. You got your kids safe out of there. They're now in a safe shelter. They have three meals a day. To me, you are like Wonder Woman." And that was just cognitively reframing that experience. And all of a sudden she went from this rather depressed, dejected look, and I could see a smile on her face. You know, it wasn't a high IQ kind of thing to do. It was just helping her re-see her situation in a different way.
That's a great example. So I know I just want to do a quick check-in. So I know it's 3 o'clock. I feel like we only have a few slides left. I feel like if people wanted to stay on, well, that's Massachusetts time. Maybe like another 15 minutes, I think we could get through the training today. Does that sound good with everyone?
I think we can. can finish up those, I think.
Yeah, we won't charge you.
Yeah.
It's might get to heaven sooner, but
a 10% cost per slide after time, which is zero. So another practical tool that Fred and I talk about a lot, and this is a little bit what you were saying with the listening groups, where when I'm deployed to the field or when I'm dealing with a crisis situation or I'm in a difficult social service area, supporting our volunteers, we do what we basically call a daily check-in. And it's a resource that creates an opportunity to listen to someone talk about where they are in that day, in that moment, with whatever their volunteer role or activity is. And I find it's really helpful in managing stress impacts, encouraging resiliency in the moment, especially when you know there's a lot going on for that person. And it follows a basic outline that creates a little bit of room to talk about core areas and begin to process what they're seeing and experiencing. Some of the basic questions, you know, what did you do today? What was one positive experience from the day? What was one challenge or negative experience from the day? Is there anything you learned today for you? And this is all about the person. And is there anything that would be helpful for you to help take care of yourself tonight? And it's essentially a tune-up where, and I always use the phrase, where you can reduce the internal emotional temperature a little bit. And we've just seen it from the disaster field, just checking in, you know, lunch, dinner, after lunch. And even though it can seem a little bit uncomfortable in the beginning, I find once people start to do it, especially if it gets embedded into a culture, people understand why you're doing it to care for one another. It can be really powerful. And the same model can be done in a group setting where it helps build community among volunteers. They get the space to share these experiences. Fred has told great examples of the disaster field where at the end of every day, his team would get together, go through these questions. Not only did it help them process, think about, empty their backpack, it built relationships, connections, and it would prepare them for the work they were going to do the next day. And it could be preventative medicine. So you're also, again, reducing the need for things to be building up over time. And then they hit a wall because they haven't had a chance to deal with any of what their daily experiences have been. So we've talked a lot of now about some of the good practical tools. You know, we did promise it wouldn't be all the heavier stuff in the beginning. But what gets in the way of doing self-care? We can all probably nod our heads. Yes, that's good. Yes, that's important. You know, I want to invest in my emotional resiliency. So what hinders us from applying these things? Because we know if we don't deal with them, they're going to accumulate. And I remember even a licensed cognitive behavioral therapist who was in one of our trainings said, and I appreciate the honesty, they said, I know all this stuff. I'm trained in this and I'm paid to tell people to do it. And yet I don't do it. And I'm struggling in my life because of that. And she said, so do as I say, not as I do. So I don't know if any of that resonates with you or reminds you of yourself, because I know it does to me at times.
There certainly are challenges in self-care. Some of us can be extremely resistant to us, and I would say maybe even most of us. And part of that, I have to say, it's just simply normal. Most of us don't like to change, even if our, you know, habits are not the most healthy. We don't like to change. And there may be some real practical reasons why we don't change. Maybe it's our self-image. Maybe it's a money issue. Maybe there's alcohol or drugs involved. Maybe we have unhealthy relationships. Maybe we're just afraid of change. Maybe we're afraid of being, we have a fear of rejection if we do change from other people. Some of us may feel like we don't have the time. Many of us might not value ourselves enough. Some of us may be so angry at ourselves that we can't even see the road ahead of us. We may be dealing with mental health issues like depression or anxiety or fear. And we don't even have the right education for us to take the next steps. Can you relate to any of those? I mean, I just went through 12 of them. You may have your own reasons.
Right. What about that sense of like not enough time? Like there's so much you feel you need to do that taking time for yourself seems like you know, you're not going to get it done, or somehow it's going to fall through. Although, again, I was a counselor in my professional life, and I know that taking that extra time is actually more productive. But it's hard to see that when you're in the middle of critical work.
And part of that is because it can be so overwhelming. And I'm reminded, and I know Chris has heard me say this 1,000 times, I think it was from Confucius, what he said many thousands of years ago. He said, people who move mountains begin by carrying small stones. And that's really an important, you know, thing to remember, is that we don't have to all of a sudden do everything all at once. All we have to do, like Chris said, you know, with that one woman who said, you know, she can just plan on having one healthy meal. And so for us, just we just making one small decision to do the right thing actually has a neurological impact on how we perceive ourselves. We feel better about ourselves, and we're more ready to do something more. So some of it is just breaking that, you know, that feeling when we get so overwhelmed down to simpler steps. So as we think about our resistance to self-care, I think what's most important is to see our resistance as a gift, or a better mystery, or a mystery to better understand ourselves. So if we can take the judgment part out and just say, why, you know, just more nonchalantly, why am I this way? And think about it, and think about the many things that are on your plate. Perhaps we can get a better understanding of who we are and potential next steps. Our attitude towards ourselves is the main theme I want to stress here. You know, learning to be, you know, we're sort of taught not to be non-judgmental towards other people. Many people have a hard time being non-judgmental and compassionate towards themselves.
And from this place, we can start to be more open. We can be more self-aware. We can make those choices. We can listen to ourselves. We can be more compassionate. And we're able to care for others better. And it helps us to grow through the hard times, as we keep saying, to become stronger and more resilient. And no matter what we're dealing with or struggling against, there are these practical steps and choices that we can make to keep pressing on and moving forward. And I'll just close with this final quote on our last slide, that when we take care of ourselves, it's much easier to have compassion with ourselves and with others.
So that's all, folks. So any final comments or questions about what we shared, which was a lot?
It is. Can we have a copy of the slides so that I can put them in an accessible format and people can read them over? Because I don't know, I hear them and that's fine, but when I read them in Braille, they imprint in my head. And many of us have devices and ways to get things into Braille if we desire.
Well, I'd have to talk with Chris about this. So can I get back to you on that?
Sure.
So any other comments? I know it's a lot of information. It was a long 2 hours, or a little over 2 hours, actually.
Yeah. We just had an intermission in between.
Yes. That was really a good cognitive reframing right there.
It was like right
than the person who said I screwed up. So,
well, and I think our encouragement would be is if there's one or two things that resonated with you. Again, it's a lot of information. You know, I think a lot of it goes into our thinking. But if there's one or two things that encourage you, or you thought about taking care of yourself better, listening to yourself better, choices you could make, you know, trying a boundary ritual, starting those listening sessions, I think that's always our encouragement. You know, what's one or two things that you could maybe think about? Lynn.
Well, when my husband died in 2016, I lived in Anchorage, Alaska. I now live in Washington State. But when he died, I just didn't think I could go on. I didn't know how to go on. And then I went to, you know, groups, and I learned that you could have a new normal. So now I'm in a doctoral program and I'm finishing, and you know, it would help me. And I, you know, and I just had to be, you think of the ways that I could be useful again, because I didn't really feel useful after that for a while. And I think that when we think about, and I've heard about post-traumatic growth because I used to teach about this kind of stuff and train on disability and trauma. But I do think that when we're trying to figure out if we can go on after a really big loss of a spouse or something like that, and moving 4,000 times, and that's also a stressor and a trauma-inducing thing. I've moved quite a bit in the last few years. Is just thinking where you can be useful again, how you can do things. And I run a couple of groups on the community and peer support groups and things like that, because I like helping people. I like being there for people. And I can't forget that I need to, you know, be cared about also. So this doctoral program is really helping me do stuff on the academic level that I never thought I would do. So that's, you know, just thinking about what you can do and change that will impact you in a good way.
And this is Stephanie. I want to echo Regina's request for the PowerPoints, or however that looks for you, you all going forward. This is a lot of great information. I feel very fortunate to have been a part of it. And you just left so much. You left so much for us to digest, and it's, you know, useful in all kinds of aspects of life. So thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Stephanie.
Any other last thoughts or comments? Again, it was a privilege for Fred and I to be here. I just see a phone number.
Yeah, that's Linda. When we went for our little break, I had to come back in on the phone rather than computer, you know, the other link when Linda can. I just have a suggestion for you two guys. I understand as a professional your hesitancy to share your entire set of slides, but if you even have handouts, or you could summarize some of the ideas into shorter handouts without giving away the entire store, we all really would appreciate it.
Thanks, Linda.
And my heart is hearing you, so.
Yeah, for sure. We'll definitely figure something out. I know we will. We always do.
Great, because a little tidbit is, for some reason, when you hear something auditorily, it hits a different part of your brain than when you read it with Braille. Braille reading is similar to visual reading in the part of the brain it stimulates, just so.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Yeah.
So a question I have, if we sent you a PowerPoint, it has text in the slides and it has text in the text portion of it. So is that something that will be useful?
Yeah, I have a conversion tool. And it'll okay. Convert it for me.
Great.
Well, I know for me, just that final reminder we mentioned earlier. I mean, I feel like we're ending on a very positive note, just with things we've talked about and encouragement. But I always have just that side of me, just to, you know, remind everyone to make a couple choices today to take care of themselves and love on themselves a little bit. If there's one thing Fred and I would say, it's do something to care for yourself today, whether from the training or because of the depth of the content we covered. So that's my final encouragement for all of us here today.
Thank you both. It is an amazing, amazing presentation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're very welcome.
Very welcome.
And we'll be in touch. Thank you
so much. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.